Greetings, greetings, once again, to all my enemies and all my friends. You may have heard the news, but stand by now for the worldview. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back. It is the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors. Well, maybe one sponsor. Maybe we could have one sponsor. No? Maybe one. No. The Weekly Worldview brought to you by God, maker of heaven and earth, and other fine products. Just, that would be the only sponsor. You had some difficulty bringing the program to market. Sponsors are somewhat skittish, apparently, to be involved with such a controversial podcast, but we haven't actually looked for sponsors because we're too busy working the family farm. Brought 3 dozen eggs to market this week. It's our biggest week ever. Three. Now, we don't want to threaten to upset the egg market in general across the country, so we're starting small, admittedly. But we have a few customers now who are waiting for their eggs, and we had one customer today prepay for future eggs. Egg futures she bought, I think. We had a customer purchase egg futures, yes. Now, we can't guarantee that the price will remain, but where it is, what with the popularity of the eggs exploding. But actually, she locked in. That's the secret of the future. See, she locked in today's rate. So to avoid future volatility is what it was. And we're very happy. We now have a barn, and we have chickens producing marketable eggs. Now, what the goats are for, I still do not know. The goats are not serving any legitimate farming function. Maybe we could hook them up to a farm implement and have them plowing the fields or something. Do some work around here. Right now, they're just... They almost qualify as pets, but we don't want to say that. They're livestock. That's right. We will be getting milk from one of those goats, maybe next season, as the family farm continues to expand. And so we're not looking for sponsorship here at the Weekly Worldview. We're hoping that the farm income will subsidize the podcast, you see. That way we won't need any sponsors. Hey, I did the math. Now, 3 dozen eggs that we sold today, that was $9. Now, if we were to...
We usually get only two dozen.
$2 a dozen?
No, 2 dozens.
Well, yeah, but let's just...
Last week we didn't...
But we're getting about $3 a dozen, right? So let's see. Let's just say that we need $9,000 a month to subsidize the lavish McBurney lifestyle and compound here, and the podcast, of course. So we got $9 this week. So that means if we can get 3,000 eggs a month to market. Let's see. Now we got 5 layers. Is that right? Well, because I'm trying to figure out exactly how we can make this work.
It's not going to work.
It's not? So we'll just go to the news of the day? Anyway, if someone could do the math on that, I just need to find out how many chickens do we need housing for in order to... All right, I suppose we'll move on. Because it was a tumultuous week. The reason I wanted to talk about chickens is because I don't want to talk about the news. I mean, this... What a tumultuous week it was, right? I mean, we started out... The beginning of the week, we had terrorist bombings in New York and New Jersey. And then we had terror stabbings at the mall in Minnesota. And then there were the police shootings in Tulsa and Charlotte, and then the riots in Charlotte night after night of the endless CNN just waiting for someone to be shot live on TV. The riots, 4 nights now they've had riots and or protests in Charlotte. And by the end of the week, it was back to the terror at the mall. a shooter goes on a rampage in a mall out in Washington State. So I have to ask, is this the new normal? Is this where we are now? Is this where our civilization has evolved now? I just wonder aloud. And at what point does the chaos and the bloodshed and the madness, at what point does that cause people to stop and say, wait a minute, maybe we need to reconsider some of our priorities? And one of our priorities should be to find a political leader whom we can trust and endorse. I have not found, well, I suppose I've endorsed Tom Hoefling over at America's Party there. But I endorse him knowing full well that in order for him to win, there would have to be some sort of catastrophic event in which all of the other candidates were suddenly eliminated from qualification. So we'll endorse Tom, and, well, we don't wish ill on anyone. We don't want anything bad to happen. What would be nice is if we found out all the other candidates were born in Canada or the Virgin Islands or Kenya, something like that. If they were all suddenly disqualified and Tom turned out to be the only guy on the ballot, that would be good. Because, well, one of the largest edifices ever created in political history crumbled this past week. That was the edifice of Ted Cruz as a real rock-ribbed conservative. That edifice crumbled. Yes, I have, right from Ted Cruz's Facebook page, his endorsements of Mr. Donald Trump for president. Ted starts out this way on Facebook. Are you ready for this? Hold on to your hats. This election is unlike any other in our nation's history. At which point everybody would have to say, wait a minute, I've been hearing that since I was in seventh grade. Is that really true, Mr. Cruz, that this...
I thought you were George W.
Was that sounded more like George W. Bush? Well, the thing is, I never heard of Ted Cruz, and I never really studied him, so it's hard for me. Now he's got the nasal Texas thing going. It's kind of hard to... Let me clear my nasal passages. Maybe I can do it better. After many months of careful consideration, of prayer, and searching my own conscience, I have decided that on Election Day, I will vote for the Republican nominee, Donald Trump. And I encourage you to vote for him, said Ted Cruz. So that's what he said on his Facebook page. So not only did, here's the thing. Not only did Ted Cruz say that he was going to vote for Donald Trump, but he encouraged others to vote for him. And therein lies the crumbling of the edifice, because it's one thing for you to give in to your fleshly desires and vote for someone who is so obviously wicked, so obviously corrupt, so obviously a liar and a charlatan and a megalomaniac. But to encourage others to do so, well, that's downright, well, it's dishonorable is what it is. It's dishonorable for Ted to do that. To all of the, well, let's just go on. He said, notice after many, many months of careful prayer, he had to pray a lot, you see. Ted wants us all to know that he didn't just pray once, maybe at dinner one night, just mentioning Donald Trump. But he went and petitioned the Lord night after night after night, and after many months of ardent prayer and petitioning to the Lord finally revealed to Ted that not only should he vote for Trump, but that he should encourage others to do so. That's what Ted is implying here. The mentioning of the prayer, also rather dishonorable. And then Ted goes into his six keys. There are six keys that inform my decision. First and most important is the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's first and most important. Wait a second. I've been hearing that since I was in seventh grade. Is that, could you really, do you really expect me to buy this, Mr. Cruz? Oh, I get it. It's a job application. How could I have missed that? Here's Ted angling for a Supreme Court appointment, and no doubt Donald J. Trump will be forthcoming with said appointment if Ted will drop any semblance of conservatism and hit the trail for Donald Trump. Can you see that? Ted Cruz standing alongside that dim-witted Eric and Ivanka, right? Can you see that on stage? Ivanka and Eric introduce Ted Cruz as he comes out, gives a stump speech for Trump. I think that's what he'll have to do to get that Supreme Court nomination. Anyway, he goes through his list of six keys. The Supreme Court will be critical. Critical, I said. Isn't that just like a lawyer, right? To rationalize in order to justify what is obviously dubious, at least, and downright dishonorable at worst. That's just like a lawyer. Give you a list of six things. And remind you that I prayed a lot. I was on bended knee. All right. So Ted Cruz has disappointed the millions and millions of gullible evangelicals and Glenn Beck that he bamboozled during the election. This actually caused a rift between me and some good friends of mine. The fact that I would not that I wouldn't endorse Ted Cruz, but that I called them gullible for believing Ted Cruz. And, hey, I'm as gullible as the next guy. We all become gullible at times. Sometimes you just have to admit it and move on. Ted Cruz is nothing more than a typical Republican politician positioning himself for a future in Republican politics, of which there shall be a future if he goes ahead and hits the trail with Ivanka. That'll be something to see. That'll be almost as interesting as if, now what was the deal? Hillary Clinton had threatened to put somebody in the front row at the debates. I can't remember who it is now. Did you happen to read that story? He asked his crack staff, research staff. No. She was going to put somebody in the front row in order to embarrass Donald Trump. And Donald then whipped out a list of like five women that Bill Clinton assaulted. And he said, if you invite that person, I'll invite all of these. Anyway, three of them already said, we want to be there, Don. Give us front row tickets. Let's see, who was it? I can't remember their names, the women that Bill Clinton abused. Their names escape me at the moment. But only seeing that would top watching Ted Cruz out shilling behind Eric Trump. That would be hilarious. And appropriate, thank you very much. Yes. Now, speaking of the debate, which I guess we're going to have to speak of it, because it is set to be the most watched presidential debate since Nixon-Kennedy, as far as percentage of the electorate. It's going to be huge. Just ask Donald Trump's people. If there's one thing Donald Trump can do, it's bring home the ratings, and he is going to do that. And I might even watch, just for the sheer entertainment value. But on to news about at least the participants in the debate. We go to the New York Post, where an ABC affiliate reporter, Sarina Fazina, she actually had the nerve to say this to Hillary Clinton. Mrs. Clinton, some doctors have said, because of your age, as well as your opponent's age, that you could be at higher risk for dementia or even Alzheimer's, and have suggested that you take some neurocognitive test. Would you be willing to do that, Mrs. Clinton? Now, I'm surprised that she wasn't assassinated after that interview, but apparently Sarina Fazina is still among us. She got away with it. But Hillary Clinton replied, I'm very sorry I got pneumonia, okay? And now Sarina Fazina did not follow up and say, well, Yeah, that doesn't answer my question. She let Clinton go on and on about how I took antibiotics and took care of it and it's behind us now. What difference does it make at this point if it's Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or pneumonia? It's time to move on. But Sarina Fazina came back and asked specifically, yes, Mrs. Clinton, but would you submit to the testing? Please don't hurt me, please. Would you submit to the test, a neurocognitive test? And Hillary replied, there's no need for that. These are not the droids you're looking for, Sarina Fazina. The information I've released about my health is very clear. Got it, sweetheart? The information, says Hillary Clinton, is very clear. But Mrs. Clinton, that's what we'd like to find out. Is the information very clear to you, Mrs. Clinton? That's why everybody wants a piece of the action. Everybody needs a main attraction. And that's what everybody needs. Satisfaction guarantees. Everybody wants a piece of the action. Worldview. And I am your host, Doug McBurney, on the eve of the big debate. Yes. And I've been in my mind, I've been imagining what it must be like behind the scenes at Donald Trump headquarters, debate prep at Donald Trump headquarters in preparation for Hillary Clinton as he circles with his inner circle to prepare for the debate. And you know it's got to be coming up. How do we prepare for what could happen, Don, in the debate with Hillary Clinton? Don, we got to think about this, okay? This is going to be an important debate for us. This could make or break the entire election. Everything hinges on this first debate. Donald, we have to be prepared. All right, let's get prepared. Okay, what if she coughs? What are we going to do? If she coughs, okay, is it like a long extended cough? Is it a hard clearing of the throat? I need to know how to react. Let's say she just, it's a spastic cough. It's uncontrollable spasms of coughing with phlegm flying across the stage. I think you want to offer her water. I think so, right? I mean, you want to appear courteous, Don, that's the thing. You want to appear courteous, but not chauvinistic, right? Okay, it's a fine line to walk. So if the spittle and the phlegm are flying, I think you don't want to bring the water over to her, but you do want to hold out the glass in her direction, letting America know that you want to help, that you would like to offer her water. But of course, her handlers would be on the stage at that point, possibly giving her the water. And so I think we're prepared for the cough, right? What's going to be the head nod, the body motion towards her, holding out the glass will be the thing. Okay, that's now, what if she swoons? If she's holding onto the lectern and it looks obviously like she could fall over at any moment. Okay, should I run over and catch her? I think that's too aggressive, Don. I don't think you want to run over and catch her. If she swoons, I think you want to make the move toward her, again with the head nod, turn the shoulders, but I think you want to keep your distance here, okay? Again, we want to appear to be courteous, and we want to be empathetic, but of course we don't want to appear chauvinistic in any way, or that you're trying to show her up in the fact that you're able to run over there while she is swooning and dizzy. So I think, again, the feint, maybe reach out with the right arm to let America know that you would like to help. All right. And now, okay, let's say she keels over straight up, a header right into the stage. She flat out keels over. Well, I think I should run over there, and I think I should pick her up. Run over there and pick her up? I'm not sure, Don. That may be a little bit aggressive. You'd be invading her space, and she might legitimately need medical attention. I mean, there could be a lawsuit there. I mean, you don't want to get... I think that you want to go to a neutral corner. I think you would want to leave the stage at that point. Don't take advantage of the fact that you're able to remain upright while she is lying splayed out upon the stage. I think that's the way to handle that if she is to actually keel over, Don, okay? We're going to go to a neutral corner. It's like a prize fight, Don. Yes. You don't want to gloat, you know? You don't want to do the Muhammad Ali with the fist in the air. No. We're gonna slowly, gradually step back out of the spotlight and allow the medical professionals to do their business. All right, so we got that. Now, what if she dies? Okay, fellas, what are we going to do if she flat out dies? I think the best strategy is not to mention it and to just continue with our talking points during the debate so as not to appear to be trying to upstage her with the fact that you are still alive and she has unfortunately passed from the scene. We may want to work in something about what a wonderful human being she was and how much she cared about women and children. So again, we can appear empathetic, you know, but not be chauvinistic in any way. All right. Now, are there any other points we need to cover for the debate? No, I believe that. I believe that we've got all of our bases covered. All right. All right. Go get him, Don. Break a leg. Knock him dead. All right, we're back here at the Weekly Worldview. That was coverage behind the scenes at the debate prep at Trump Tower, an exclusive live feed fed to us here at the Weekly Worldview. So there we have it. Otherwise, I think that if Trump overthinks this and tries to actually prepare, I think the only preparation he needs is to get a good night's sleep, and that's all. And Hillary, I think she needs like 3 weeks of sleep and a perfectly titrated dose of Xanax and amphetamines to try to get her through it. And I'm sure she's got some of the finest doctors in the world working on that so that she will remain upright through the debate and somewhat cognizant as she's able to be, as if it makes any difference at this point. Yes, this will be the first debate. This will be the first debate where the network is required to have a crash cart on scene. Yeah, those aren't cheap. That's an expense that the network had not anticipated, but for which they will take responsibility and make sure that they have the crash cart with the defibrillator and the IV. The trach tube, the whole thing. Nothing left to chance when Hillary Clinton hits the stage. All right. Now, let's go on in deeper. That was from the politics file, as you can well imagine. We'll move even deeper now into the politics file as we move to a story that when it first appeared on Drudge, it was in the giant red letters that Drudge uses when he expects a story to be earth-shattering. And the story is, as reported in Politico, that Barack Obama, the President of the United States, while he was President on June 28, 2012, used a pseudonym in email communications with then-Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton. Now, a pseudonym, if you matriculated in the government schools, a pseudonym is a name that's not your own. It's something you make up. It might be like your name or like something that's associated to you, but it's not your actual name because you're trying to conceal your identity. Or if you're an author, you might make up a name like Mark Twain or something like that. A pseudonym, okay? For all of our publicly educated listeners out there, I want to help you out. Don't go running to Google. I can help you with definitions of relatively simple grammatical terms. So Barack Obama uses a pseudonym in communication with Hillary Clinton on her homebrew server, on her unsecured private server. This disclosure has been revealed, or was revealed, when the FBI released documents from its investigation into Clinton's alleged criminal activity. Now, Politico does not say that the FBI was investigating any alleged criminal activity. I had to insert that because what Politico says is that the FBI was investigating Clinton's private email server. And as my friend and pastor, Bob Enyart, and the host of Bob Enyart Live, pointed out so skillfully, that this is a very well-played political ploy by the Clintons and the compliant press to cover up the fact that what everyone is investigating is actually alleged criminal activity by making sure that they always use the term private email server, where with any other human being on the planet, reporters and press outlets would report that the FBI was investigating alleged criminal activity. But for Hillary, no. We don't ever mention the possibility that it might have been criminal activity. It was just a server, you see. A server is what it was. But like the millennials will never catch that one. It was a server, you see. I think at Chipotle, something like that. So anyway, just a very insidious marriage between left-wing politicians and left-wing reporters. And it has now matured to the point where the reporters and the politicians no longer make any bones about the fact that they're colluding together to deceive and to dissemble in order to get whatever said left-wing politician we might be talking about. In this case, it's Hillary Clinton, but they want to work to get her elected. And there's no longer even the facade of impartiality even attempted anymore, because everybody knows what's going on. And nobody seems to mind anymore. And hence this story, which should be, well, bigger than Watergate. This is bigger than Watergate. The president lied about, so, well, I found out that Hillary had a, what was that? She had a private server. Oh, a non-state.gov email. You're kidding me. I heard about that. I think the first time was from CBS News Reports is how I heard about that. And I was somewhat concerned about it. I found out through news reports. Well, on June 28, 2012, he emailed her under a pseudonym at that address, for crying out loud. But nobody seems to care. Drudge's giant red headline has now faded to a little footnote because no longer is there any even an attempt to hide the fact that the left-wing media is not impartial in any way. They're in the bag for Hillary Clinton or whatever pro-abort socialist homo politician that they want to see get elected. And, well, I guess I'm just stating the obvious, and I apologize for that. It's just that it bothers me still. I'm one of the few people, I think, who's still bothered by this. Let's see here. They don't get into the contents of the email. The State Department has refused to make public that and other emails that Hillary exchanged with Obama. And lawyers have cited the presidential communications privilege. See, the president has the privilege to communicate with his cabinet without those communications becoming public. And then that I understand, Mr. President. I understand that you have the right to communicate with your cabinet in what is expected to be a secure environment, so that your private conversations won't be leaked out to the whole world, or you can't be forced to release private conversations between you and your cabinet. But Mr. President, are we to assume now that you have the right to lie right to our face about it? Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Doug McBurney, your host, joined in studio, as always, by my extremely attractive audio engineer. A whole lot of suckers and a whole lot of fools out there, in my opinion. So not only does Barack Obama have the audacity to lie right to our face about when he knew about Hillary's alleged criminal activity and even participated in it, emailing her on an unsecure server, not only does he have the gall to lie to us about that and know that nothing will be done. See, that's the thing. He's got that look, that proud look. Like he knows you can't even touch me. And you can just see it. He drips off him. And it's an arrogance that I have rarely observed in any human being. Fueled, no doubt, by America's tolerance, well, for his arrogance and his criminal behavior. And now he goes to this museum. All right, so in an effort made by George W. Bush back during his pathetic presidency to get liberals to like him, he signed a law that authorized the construction of the National Museum of African American History and culture. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Barry Ho went there last week to open it up. And he gave a speech. A speech that was just the most divisive, vicious. How do I describe the speech? It was like a snake had coiled up around the microphone and was just spitting venom into the microphone against white people. That's the way I interpreted the speech. I got to see clips of it. It was just, well, let me just read a few of the quotes from Barry Ho's opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture. No white people allowed. Thank you very much. This is going to be for black people, not for white people. And Barry remarked at the opening of the museum for black people only, quote, "A museum alone will not alleviate poverty. It won't eliminate gun violence. It won't ensure that justice is always colorblind." You know what I mean by that? White cop shooting black boy. Yep, that's what I meant. "It won't wipe away discrimination, like when the cops shoot all those black, unarmed black men." Yep. Discrimination. Did I use the word discrimination? I want to make sure that you understand I'm talking about discrimination. This museum will not wipe away discrimination. That requires speaking and speaking out and organizing. But what this museum does show us Oh, by the way, speaking and organizing, like in Charlotte, speaking out, organizing, like Charlotte, late at night, after midnight. But what this museum does show us is that even in the face of oppression, did I say the word oppression? I meant oppression, because we're still oppressed. I'm the first black president, but we're all very oppressed, like in Charlotte, after midnight. Even in the face of oppression, even in the face of unimaginable difficulty, America has moved forward. Perhaps this museum can help a visitor understand the pain and anger of demonstrators in places like Ferguson and Charlotte. You thought I was just going to imply Charlotte? No, I actually said it. I said Charlotte. That's right. Riots. Charlotte after midnight. And it will help black visitors appreciate that within white communities, we see the sincerity of law enforcement officers and officials who in fits and starts are struggling to understand and are trying to do the right thing. In fits and starts, of course, because they don't understand and they most often do the wrong thing. The police often act stupidly. So that was Barry's, that was my impression, okay? So I know what Barry said, and that's what I heard, okay? Was he opens up this museum and gives just a flat-out racist, divisive speech. You know, it's almost as if, and I'm not a big conspiracy guy, but it's almost as if Barry Ho wants to light 10,000 fuses before he leaves the White House. And whatever poor slob walks into that job next is going to be like walking into a minefield. The whole country is going to be exploding left and right. A 10,000 fuses, yeah. All right. Let's go now to the Charlotte incident. The family of Keith Lamont Scott, who was the man shot by Charlotte police. Oh, I'm sorry. He was the black man shot. We've got to mention that, of course. Black man shot by some black and white police in Charlotte, male and female. Black man shot by Charlotte police this week. His family released a video. Have you seen this? It's the cell phone video of Keith's wife. And the report here from the United Press International says that the video depicts his wife pleading with officers, "Don't shoot him!" But that's just a little bitty part of it. That's not the key part of the video. And I've seen both videos now, and you just can't tell what happened because of the video. You just can't tell. In fact, I have a report on the other video. Let's talk about... So we've got the shaky cell phone video of the woman who is... Well, she's his wife. So would it be safe to assume that she loves this man? I mean, would it be logical, I should say, to assume that she loves him, right? You would assume that since she's his wife. Well, I'm going to get back to her video because that was one of the more bizarre things I've ever seen in my life. But let's go to Charlotte, where the Charlotte Mecklenburg police released the videos from dash cam from the shooting. And it shows Keith Scott surrounded by officers. Let's see. Scott drew the attention of officers. They were out to serve an arrest warrant on an unrelated suspect when they saw him rolling a joint in his car. So that gets the police's attention, right? That's how they notice Keith Scott. They're there to serve a warrant. He's rolling a joint in his car. Well, the police say they were going to let it go. They weren't going to arrest the guy because he's just rolling a joint. They're trying to serve a warrant. They were going to let it go until an officer spotted a weapon in the vehicle. So now you've got a situation where he's rolling a joint and he's got a firearm. So according to the police chief, he says, well, now there's a serious crime here. The gun has now exacerbated the situation. Now the police are pretty much forced to act. I think marijuana is still illegal in, what state is this? Which of the Carolinas? Charlotte, North Carolina? I think pot's still illegal. So the cops see a gun. He walked into some trouble here by acting the fool is what Keith Scott did. Rolling a joint in front of a bunch of police, got a gun. I don't know how they saw the gun, but there they see the gun. So the video now shows Scott surrounded by officers. He opens his car door. He steps out, turns, and walks backwards with his hands at his side. At least four times in the video, you hear the cops saying, "Drop the gun. Drop the gun." Now, unless you're the most maniacal Black Lives Matter crazy, you have to ask yourself, why did the police say drop the gun? Now, if you're a Black Lives Matter crazy, you know that the cops, they just making this up so they can shoot a brother. That's all. They saying drop the gun because they know this video going to come out. They just want to shoot a man. That's all. They want to shoot a brother. Okay, but for us rational people, why did the police say drop the gun at least four times? Now, we can't see the gun. Now, but why would they say drop the gun? So that's some clue that there was a gun and that it was in Keith Scott's hands. But there's more evidence against Keith Scott, and it doesn't come from the police video. It comes from the bizarre video released by his wife, his family, I should say, shot by his wife, in which it's eerily reminiscent of the video that the girlfriend shot when her gangster thug boyfriend was shot to death by police in the car right next to her. And so instead of screaming and freaking out and doing whatever a normal person would do when the love of your life is shot and bleeding, she whips out her camera, starts shooting a video, making a political statement. This video was eerily reminiscent of that. And at one point in the wife's video, she yells twice, "Keith, don't do it. Keith, don't do it." And then you hear pop, 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 pop. So what was she telling Keith not to do? And why did Keith apparently do it? Well, I'm sure the facts will come out. But the audio evidence from these two videos combined convinced me that Keith was probably yet another depressed, disillusioned Black man abandoned by his father, more than likely. So he hates authority. He hates justified authority. He hates righteous authority because his own family abandoned him. And he may very well have been suicidal. I mean, that's my take on what I heard. He very well may have been suicidal. Why else do you keep holding onto a gun when you're surrounded by four or five police officers? They've got their guns pointed at your heart and your head, and they're telling you to drop the gun. Why do you not drop the gun? I think maybe he's suicidal. All right, so that's my take. All right. So that's more from the tumult of the week. Do we want to move into the terrorism? The terrorism fell off the front pages faster than I'm shocked to go from Monday, wall-to-wall coverage of a bombing in Manhattan. To by the middle of the week, it's back to Black Lives Matter and riots in the streets. It's just a bizarre, tumultuous, strange week. Because you would have thought Ahmad Khan Rahami, the New York City bomber, New Jersey resident, you'd have thought he would have been top of the news all week. After all, it was a bombing in Manhattan. But for whatever reason, he was not. Turns out, according to the New York Times, they have a real sad sob story in their Sunday edition about Ahmad Khan Rahami and how he went from just a harmless class clown to now an ISIS terrorist. And they tell his sad story, how his dad was mean to him and all this. And they also have a couple of interesting tidbits. The Federal Bureau of Investigation investigated Ahmad Khan Rahani in 2014. Looks like they investigated him for about 15 minutes and then decided he was perfectly fine. Why were they investigating him? Well, in 2013, he left for a nearly year-long stay in Pakistan, along with some trips to Turkey and Afghanistan. But after about 15 minutes of questioning, the FBI determined that there was no grounds for any further investigation. I guess it was kind of like the investigation they held with Hillary Clinton, Cheryl Mills. You know, they spent just enough time to make people think that maybe they had earned their money, and then they decided, well, it's all well and good. There's nothing more to see here, folks. Let's just move along. I'm Doug McBurney. Yes. So the terrorism narrative, which was a real narrative, by the way, it really happened, a real bomb. It really blew up and it really hurt a lot of people. And the fellow who planted the bomb is really a terrorist. Pakistan, Turkey, Afghanistan, this is all real. Well, that narrative was hijacked midweek by the Black Lives Matter narrative. That its police are just always out gunning, trying to shoot unarmed black men. That's what police do. And here we have another example, another example out in Tulsa, an example in Charlotte. But the terrorists were not to be outdone, because by the end of the week, another terrorist has struck. Fox News reports that a suspected gunman, believed to have killed five people, has been arrested. That's right. They arrested him on Saturday. His name is Arkan Setin, and he is, he immigrated to the U.S. from Turkey and was a legal permanent resident. Setin had been arrested, on assault charges, three domestic violence assault charges against his stepfather. It's the guy who's beating up his stepfather. His stepfather's probably trying to prevent him from becoming a maniac terrorist. Well, I don't know all the details of his personal life, but here we have another Islamic terrorist by week's end shooting up a mall. I believe he killed four. He slaughtered three women and one man inside of a Macy's at the mall. This is people being slaughtered at the mall, for crying out loud. That was the conclusion of a rather tumultuous week, in which it was like, pick your poison. Do you want to talk about the terrorists who are shooting up our malls and stabbing people? Do you want to talk about the rioters who are smashing windows and shooting one another in Charlotte? Do you want to talk about the fact that there's an outright war on police? Or do you want to talk about the fact that there seems to be more and more mentally deranged, suicidal people who are committing suicide by cop, quite possibly in an attempt to set the police up to make it look like they were shooting an unarmed man in order to further push this narrative. It's just craziness. And it's getting difficult to watch. It becomes difficult to comment on without repeating oneself. But when it's the same stories over and over, I guess you end up repeating yourself. So I don't want to repeat myself. I want to be able to move on. So let's go to the justice file with probably the most ironic story of the week. And it comes to us from the New York Post. The Post reports, let me just read you the headline. It is no longer safe for New York City senior citizens to go outside. Yes, the Post reports that more than once a day on average this year, someone over the age of 65 was mugged somewhere in New York City. And given the choice between safety and freedom, New York City's senior citizens are choosing the former. For those of you who matriculated in the public schools, that means they're choosing safety over freedom. Yeah, strong-arm robberies, that means they're staying home. They're afraid to leave their house. Okay? So when you were living in a third-world country in the 1970s and there was a junta walking the street with machetes, you would be afraid to leave your house. Well, that senior citizens in New York City are now living a similar experience. It's as if the Tonton Macoute is outside. Yeah. Well, the strong-arm robberies are up in New York City. Over 300 strong-arm robberies just of senior citizens this year through September. The Post reports that a 93-year-old woman in East Harlem broke New Yorkers' hearts when a craven mugger plucked her pension cash right out of her bra as she sat in her wheelchair. And there was video of this. And people around New York City were shocked that this was happening right there in their city. But they were not shocked enough to stand up and demand justice. You know, we've got people marching in the streets over a false narrative of police on a bloody rampage against young, unarmed black teenagers. But what we don't see is a legitimate uprising amongst the normal, rational people in this country to march in the streets and demand justice. Demand justice. We've got, my grandma can't even leave her apartment in Queens, for crying out loud. Right? My great uncle in Manhattan, he's afraid to go outside. He defeated the Japanese in World War II. Now he's hunkered down in his apartment, terrified. I mean, what country are we living in? I mean, there should be people marching in the streets. There's absolutely a need for people to march in the streets. And ask these lawyers, when did you people decide that we were going to be tolerating this level of violence and bloodshed? How did this happen? I mean, some heads should roll, for crying out loud. People should be marching demanding justice. Not social justice. There's no such thing as social justice. What is that? That's a communist construct, social justice. That's designed to make poor people mad at rich people. Social justice. What about real justice? How about that? You're not even going to be able to have your march for social justice if you're afraid to leave your apartment. Now, I called this the most ironic story of the week. And the reason I find this ironic is because America's senior citizens are people between the ages of 65 and 85 years old, right? On average, 65 to 85 years old. So walk with me on a little bit of math. Where do you think these people who are now cowering in their apartments, how many of them do you think were marching in the 1960s to overturn everything that was right and good in America? How many of these hippies who marched against everything that their grandparents stood for, how many of them are now cowering in their apartments, experiencing the fruit of their labors as teenagers and young adults? I find that, I hope they see the irony of it. They wanted to throw off all the conventions, all the traditions, no religion, no God, call the police pigs, get high in the streets. Why don't we do it in the road? All of that. And now they're afraid to leave their apartments. Thank you very much, you hippie scum. Anyway, a majority of the people hiding out in their apartments in New York were not burning their bras and their draft cards. No, they're the collateral damage of the hippie generation, which is represented very, very well by Hillary Rodham Clinton and her lecherous, disgusting husband, who still have a political career and who still are working on bringing it all down as fast as they can and as best as they can, while preserving as much of their personal wealth as possible, I might add. But what difference does it make at this point how much money we have? Yeah. That's it. We're pretty much coming to the end. So let's end with Stephen Hawking, who comes to us from the science, really, file Yes. Yes. Let's see. CNET is reporting that Stephen Hawking is again warning us about announcing our presence to any alien civilizations that might be out there. Yep. He says we should especially be concerned about those aliens who are more technologically advanced than we are. Apparently, Steve has a new half-hour program on some, who knows where. He says, if intelligent life has evolved out there, we should be able to hear it. One day, we might receive a signal from a planet like this, but we should be wary of answering back. Meeting an advanced civilization could be like Native Americans encountering Columbus. That did not turn out so well, he says. Well, I don't know. Why does he have to slam Columbus? He's talking about aliens? I guess when you're a leftist, you never miss an opportunity to take a swipe at anything that represents tradition, and especially Christian tradition. Oh, boy. So anyway, Hawking is both worried and excited about finding aliens. Yes, he's one of the smartest men, one of the highest IQs ever recorded. And he's excited about finding aliens, but he's a little scared. Yeah. Let's see. He says, ultimately, the argument over to reach out to extraterrestrials could be a moot point if, as some ancient astronaut theorists believe, aliens have already been in touch and visiting Earth for centuries. Well, actually, I don't know if that was Stephen Hawking or the CNET author. I don't know which one of them is a big fan, obviously, of ancient aliens. By the way, ancient aliens is actually just Nouveau Greek mythology. It is entertaining to watch. What with Mario Antoinette and the hair and the crazy. But they're basically laying out a tableau of gods similar to ancient Greece. And I was stunned to find out later in life, because as a child I learned about Greek mythology. I never thought anyone actually believed that. But it turns out a lot of people did believe that. Yeah, there's a society's loaded with suckers and fools. You kidding me? That's the show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Doug McBurney. That's the Weekly Worldview. I can't remember how I closed the show. I'm drawing a blank on how to get out of here. I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, at American Right to Life, and of course my other brother Daryl, who is off to Wisconsin, but he will still be a part of making everything happen here at the Weekly Worldview, right here in the studio. Should the Lord tarry, we will return next week, and until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.